May it please the court, Jesse Witt for the appellant Countryside Community Association. If the court is familiar with the record, I'll proceed directly to arguments.
Go ahead.
Thank you. Obviously, this is a case about maintenance costs, and I'd like to emphasize three points today. One, under Section 307 of Kiowa, Pulte had a duty to reimburse the association for the cost of maintaining Pulte's property that was within the community. And two, under principles of unjust enrichment, Pulte is liable to the association for the cost of reimbursing any maintenance costs related to the property outside the community. And three, in either case, Pulte's employees breached their fiduciary duties by using homeowner money to maintain Pulte's unsold properties. Pulte is clearly responsible for its employees' actions. Turning to the first point, Section 307. The statute clearly states that in addition to the liability the declarant has as a unit owner, the declarant alone is liable for all expenses in connection with real estate within the community that's subject to development rights.
Okay. What is your position on when property is within the community?
Well, that's an interesting question here. I think it was a disputed fact. Pulte seems to be equating within the common interest community with annexation, and we don't think that's correct. They could have said that in the statute if they meant it. Instead, they put in language stating that an association can enforce an assessment as if this property were a unit, which would be contrary to the idea that it had to be annexed under the applicability for or the process for annexing a unit. A more reasonable interpretation of that in the association's view would mean that when a plat's recorded, when documents are recorded that reference these properties as annexable, identify them as being within the community boundaries, that's the intent there of the property being within the community.
Where does that come from? What law? What document?
Well, that would be in a couple of places. One would be simply the text of the statute.
But it doesn't say anything about recording the plat. That's where I'm saying, where does
true.
That come from?
The statute's not real clear as to what it means by within the community there. In the trial court, Pulte basically conceded that it owned property that was subject to the section, so it wasn't really developed any further. Something I noted, page 281 of the record in their reply brief, Pulte conceded this point, so it wasn't presented to the trial court as a question of whether this applied. They went on to argue that some of the assessments related to other charges and disputes or the factual basis of that. But our position would initially be that it's not really an issue in the appeal because it was conceded in the court below. Conceded, I would note, prior to further discovery. The court allowed the association to take further discovery, submit a supplemental brief, and had that point not been conceded, they likely would have obtained further information evidence to put into the record.
Well, let me ask this question. The section on annexation and the declarations, it talks about annexing additional property. So what would be the initial property?
Well, the annexation provision, I would say, is described as a somewhat different process. There's property that may be physically inside the community boundaries, you know, within the identified on the plat, recognized as being, again, within the property, treated by Pulte as being within the property, but not yet annexed until a deed is reported. So I think the day of annexation may be separate from the day the property is actually within the community.
Well, the section on assessments talks about the declarant Pulte being an owner, and so when would they get a deed reported? Don't they already have a deed when they have, as owners of the property?
Correct.
Okay, and so you're saying that Pulte does that property doesn't become annexed until some owner records a deed?
There's different procedures. There's two procedures in the declaration. There is an option to formally just record an amendment or something that says land X is hereby annexed, or it automatically comes into the property if Pulte sells the property to another party.
Right. Well, let's say you have some land that's within the meets and bounds of your original plat, but it's not been divided into lots, and then Pulte carves a piece of that out and transfers it to a third party. Isn't that what that deed, transfer to a third party deed in the annexation portion means?
I would say yes in that context, It does. That is how it probably would affect an annexation.
Okay, so you're saying that would affect an annexation, but also the 180, the piece of the property that's carved into 186 lots, it's not annexed until it's sold to a third party?
I think that's right. I think there was some disputed testimony as to that. I think ultimately that's a procedure set forth in the declaration. There was some factual questions about whether the parties actually behave that way, and whether Pulte acted as though all of the properties were within the community. The relevance of Section 307 is that this applies basically as a backstop sort of to catch property that wasn't annexed, but the association is still being forced to maintain.
Okay, let me ask you about that though, because under Article 4 of the declarations, it's talking about assessments, which could be used to maintain the common areas, right? But 307 uses a different term. It talks about
expenses,
which seems to me would maybe directly relate to property that's subject to development rights, but it might not be so broad as to cover assessments. So I'm asking you, are you saying that the two are mutually overlapping, that they're the same equivalent, or are there differences?
I think they're definitely overlapping. They might be the same, there might be some difference. That would, again, I think be a factual dispute that could have been argued in the trial court, but wasn't.
Well, counsel, you keep saying it's a factual dispute. It's a term in a statute. We have to determine what the legal meaning of that is. We have to determine what the legal meaning of these requirements are. Those aren't factual disputes.
Correct, but the value of the amount would be, and maybe I'm anticipating a different question there. I think common expense liability is going to overlap with assessments. Typically under the declaration, the association can charge assessments to recoup its common expenses. In this particular case, the association took a position that they were basically equal. And that's why I said this is maybe a bit of a factual issue. I think whether they're exactly the same in all cases, it would probably need to be a case-by-case determination of that.
Well, but your entire argument is premised on the idea of expenses including these assessments. So don't we have to decide whether expenses include assessments? If it doesn't, then how can you...
I would disagree. I think the trial court needed to or could examine whether the common expenses and the assessments were equal, or whether the assessments were the appropriate means of calculating the common expense. But the common expense was certainly there, and by default, the declaration sets the assessments as basically equal to the common expense. And that was the evidence that the association submitted, was that Pulte is liable for these common expenses associated with unannexed property. The association has the right to treat those as if they were units, even though they haven't been annexed yet. And the association's position was that the common expense is equal to the assessment, which again is, I believe, the default calculation that the declaration requires. It states that the common expense presumably is the total expenses that the association maintains divided by 186. And the reason I say that there's a factual element there is that the problem with the trial court's order here is it never got to that question. It simply said dismiss the whole case without any real findings on that point. It just said that if the property's not annexed, it can't be subject to this.
But what about this provision in the declaration defining lot? It defines lot, but then it defines lots that may be included in the same provision, which are the 186 units we're talking about here. That indicates to me that those are not lots. Those are lots that may be included. And how do they get included?
They get included by annexation. They get included as lots by annexation.
Okay. So until they're annexed, I mean, what's the effect of that vis-a-vis this case?
Well, the effect is that the association is paying to maintain those lots prior to that annexation. And under Section 307, when that happens, the association has a right to go back and request reimbursement of those costs from the declarant, because Section 307 also prohibits an association from spending homeowner funds to maintain property that's subject to declarant rights.
Well, but this depends upon whether you're right that even if they're not lots, even if they're not annexed, they are still within the common interest community.
Correct.
Okay, if they're not within the common interest community, would you agree that 307 has no application here?
Yes, I would agree with that. We were talking about property that was completely outside the community, you know, in a different development, maybe adjacent across the street. 307 would not apply to that. But here, you know, this property was within the, it was physically attached to all the other homes, and I think it would be incorrect to assume that, or to equate the term within the community as annexed into the community.
Yeah, and I guess what troubles me is, well, what do we look to decide, I mean, what law, what do we hang our hat on to decide this is how we define within the common interest community? This is how a property becomes part of the common interest community. That's what's troubling us. What do we look at?
Well, I think we look, in this particular case, at the actions of the parties, at the fact that, you know, the testimony of the Pulte always behaved as though all 186 were...
That's not a legal standard. I mean, that could vary from case to case. There's got to be some kind of a legal test.
Well, I'm not sure there is, Your Honor. I think, you know, this is really a question of first impression, and, you know, the courts haven't decided it. The authority we attached indicated that Kiowa needs to be construed broadly. The statute says that. We attached the article from Jerry Horton, noting that, you know, this is basically how the statute was intended to operate. And we noted that this provision here was unique to Colorado. It was added by the drafters. Right. So based on that, I think the court can infer that the intent of the legislature was to provide a mechanism here for associations to recover funds exactly like it been spent here. That does require determination of, you know, whether within the common interest community should be equated to an association.
So let me see if I understand your argument on this point. As long as property is within the physical boundaries of the development, just use the broad term, it is part of the common interest community for purposes of 307.
Yes. And just to kind of wrap up here, I'd like to say some time for rebuttal.
Mr. Witt, I'm going to extend your time.
Thank you.
We have a lot of questions here, and we'll be extending your time. And so let me ask some questions. Under 307.2, says in addition to the liability that a declarant as a unit owner has under this article. Now, can you succinctly summarize for me when does a declarant become a unit owner?
Sure. The Kiowa provisions are written in general, so there's absolutely cases, you know, I personally had it, and there are examples out in other matters where property may be annexed while the declarant still owns it. It could be where there is some a different developer comes in and succeeds to declarant rights. It could simply be a different form of declaration whereby, instead of saying that there's no property until it's sold or annexation recorded, all these units are in the community as of this date and owned by the declarant.
Okay, and here you're saying that the declarant was a unit owner?
No, because Pulte didn't own any of these. At the time Pulte owned them, they weren't units.
Okay.
They were sort of unclassified real estate.
So the things that a unit owner would be liable for, it appears to me, appear in 307.1, where it says that each unit owner is responsible for the maintenance, repair, and replacement of such owner's unit. And each unit owner shall afford to the association and the other unit owners a right of way, essentially. Access. So if they're not yet a unit owner, then they are not yet responsible for maintenance, repair, and replacement of their own unit.
Well, in this case, that again leads to kind of a thorny, really factual question. The problem is Pulte owned this property. Legally, in a technical sense, it was not a unit. They were not units because they hadn't been annexed under the unit annexation procedure. So there really was a question of who was supposed to be maintained.
So that's fine. So what I am taking from this is that under 307.2, this particular clause that in addition to the liability they have as a unit owner, they alone are responsible for all expenses in connection with the real estate. And what I'm thinking from this is, they really didn't have any liabilities as a unit owner. If they have liabilities, those are for expenses in connection with real estate within the common interest community subject to development rights.
That's what subsection 2 applies to.
And that's what you're arguing, is that this is the liability they have.
Correct.
All right, now, then the question I guess I would ask is liability to whom?
I haven't really looked at that before. I think, first off, to make a slight correction to what you were saying earlier about subsection 1, I don't think that's an exhaustive list of unit owner responsibilities. And I think the provision here, when it says in addition to the liability that the declarant as a unit owner has, I think that merely means, let's just try to emphasize that this is separate from anything that the developer owes as the unit owner. The developer may choose to keep 20 units in the community as rentals, for instance. They'll be annexed in, they'll pay assessments,
okay.
But the developer's, you know, has all the same responsibilities that you or I would have as a homeowner. Subsection 2 kicks in this situation that we have in this case, where the property that hasn't been annexed in, the association's still paying to maintain it, but it hasn't really been annexed in, so it can't be assessed as a unit, because it's not really a unit, but it's not really a common element. It's just this property that the association's paying for.
What is the association maintaining it or paying for?
Because Pulte's board members were the ones holding the purse strings, and they were cutting the checks to pay for that property.
When they were in control of the
Correct.
HOA.
Correct.
And so, and are you saying that the only reason the association was doing this is not because they had any legal liability to do it, but rather because it became the custom of this particular HOA based on when the Pulte employees were in charge?
I would agree with that, and I would add that there is no way physically to separate the property. We're dealing with, you know, joint interest in you know, a wall, for instance, that may shield 5 buildings, of which Pulte owns 4 of them, but there's a homeowner in 1. The homeowner association has a contractual duty under the declaration to maintain the exterior of that owner's home, which also benefits Pulte. It has no duty to maintain the exterior of Pulte's lots, but it can't physically send somebody out there to paint a finite area on a wall that's attached to 4 of the units.
So if I'm understanding correctly, your argument would be that to the extent that Pulte's development rights, non-unit, if you will, development rights, are adjacent to sold units, that there might be a piece of the property that the association would normally take responsibility for because it's essentially adjacent to a unit. Is that, were these assessments all based on that type of maintenance, or did it include maintenance that went, you know, beyond the boundary line?
I know according to the property manager's affidavit, it certainly did include that. And this is kind of what I was referring to with the sort of factual issue that gets entwined here when I was speaking with Judge Jones. There was never any factual dispute as to what went into those assessments. I think it is a permissible argument that a defendant could make that, wait, you calculated this wrong. This assessment, I'm liable for 75% of this assessment, but not all of it, and here's why. That was never done because the case never went to trial, and I want to be clear on that point because having dispensed with this case at the summary judgment level, that issue was never evaluated. Pulte, as the movement on the summary judgment motion, never met its burden in proving that there were additional charges in there for which it's not responsible.
Did you raise that as a genuine issue, a factual issue? In other words, you got to establish an issue of fact in order to survive summary judgment. Did you raise factual issues, or did you argue strictly the legal issues?
First thing, I was the trial counsel, but the trial counsel on this did submit the affidavit from the property manager, which identified certain discrete charges that Pulte identified the discrete charge for capital improvements, and then also indicated that the assessments or the amounts that Pulte board members have approved included monies that went strictly to benefit Pulte's lots. So the question of whether the specific amount of assessments was, for instance, overstated or included items that Pulte had a defense to, that was never briefed by either party in the trial court.
So let me again understand, when you refer to the approvals by Pulte employees, some of the assessments pertained to expenses incurred by the HOA before the HOA was transferred to the owners?
Yes.
And some of it was expenses incurred after?
Correct.
All right. I know I've taken more of your time. We'll give you more
Thank
time.
You.
Do you have, and briefly, just anything you would like to say before you sit for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. Very briefly, just want to hit the other two points I had alluded to earlier. The second being unjust enrichment, and to say this very succinctly, Pulte cannot have this both ways. Either these properties were within the community and subject to a Section 307 claim, or they were outside the community and beyond the declaration's maintenance provisions. Under the Red Iron case we cited, the trial court was obligated to make detailed findings. A lot of authority talks about how this is a very difficult, sometimes issue for courts to resolve with, and therefore to facilitate appellate review, we need to have detailed findings and a record review. Here that didn't happen, the trial court simply granted summary judgment. But again, if the court concludes that these properties were not within the common interest community for purposes of the 307 claim, then it necessarily follows that the association was performing maintenance that the declaration did not allow. It was not covered by the contract in play here. So the declaration merely refers to maintenance of common elements and exteriors of the lots. Nevertheless, Pulte's employees, and followed by association elected members who didn't really have any choice, had to spend money to maintain entire buildings. They couldn't just say, okay, this is where our liability stops. We're going to let the rest of the building fall down because there's no homeowner living in it. The association had to maintain all of that property. And in that situation, there is an absolutely valid unjust enrichment claim. That's supported by the Renner case, by the Lewis case, which notes that you have to look at whether there's a mutual or common purpose. And here, or whether it's misunderstanding, where you've got a confidential or fiduciary relationship. Here, for a large portion of the time, Pulte was holding the association's money and spending it on the wrong thing. It was spending it to maintain its own property, it was spending it on at least one capital improvement. In that situation, there is an unjust enrichment claim. The other authority for that is these restatements. Pulte cited, I think it was the original version of the restatement of restitution, and a comment to the 1937 edition, which had talked about what you do if the neighbor improves his property. But the point Pulte kind of overlooks there is that the restatement draws the difference between an improvement and a repair or maintenance. The comments dealing with improvements, give examples such as if the association decided to build a clubhouse, the restatement says they can do that, but it cannot sue Pulte in unjust enrichment because it decided to improve the property by building a clubhouse. That's different from maintaining a road, painting a building. The restatement provisions we cited in our briefing makes clear that dealing with repairs and maintenance, there is an obligation, or an obligation does arise, an unjust enrichment claim arises, such that the association or the landowner has a right of unjust enrichment against the neighboring property owners to use that. And Pulte argues that that doesn't apply because the declaration covered all this, but that's inconsistent with Pulte's other argument that the declaration, that this property is not within the community, because the declaration only speaks to property within the community. So again, Pulte can't have it both ways on that.
Mr. Whalen, I asked you about another provision in the declaration. I think we may have touched on it. It's the one that you cite first on page 3 of your opening brief. It says, each owner, including declarant, by acceptance of a deed, therefore. How does that imply that the declarant may deed property to himself? Is that what it's talking about?
To be honest, I think that's probably a vestige of another community. I think they probably took this document from another property where perhaps they did hold ownership or have rental units or something. I think, again, all of those issues were very confusing. took the association a while to figure this out. I think it was all militated against granting summary judgment because there were absolutely questions of how to interpret provisions like that.
But that's a legal question. Interpretation of documents is a legal question. It's
sure.
a contract. So what I want to know, what is your legal position as to whether under that provision the declarant is or is not an owner and why?
I would say that's an ambiguous provision that that conflicts with the other testimony. I think Pulte has argued at length that it was never a unit owner. And I think there was merit to Pulte's position insofar as it never owned property that was annexed and recognized as a, quote, lot. That provision, however, you're absolutely right, makes no sense when you confront it with that fact. So
why doesn't?
Because under the way Pulte set this community up and the position that Pulte's taken, it could never be a unit owner.
Well, it could deed the property to,
so, unless it deeded the property. So I guess it could apply to that situation.
Didn't the plat set out the lots, though?
Yes.
And so you're saying that the lots have to be transferred to a third party before they're within the community?
That's Pulte's argument, and we disagree with that. But that is Pulte's argument.
Well, you said that they're not annexed until they're transferred to a third party, and I think you're saying that the annexation is what requires to bring the property within the community.
No, that's Pulte's argument for sure. That is not our position. Our position is that the phrase within the community, as used in 307, does not necessarily require annexation. That is a more broad term that may include, for instance, referencing a lot as annexable on a plat map, recording amendments that change the boundaries of those lots, identifying, doing all these things, performing maintenance as a matter of course. All of those things could bring the property within the community because that is a more broad term than merely annexation. Now, Pulte has absolutely argued that it had no liability whatsoever until there was an annexation of a unit. We disagree with that position.
Okay, so you're saying under 307, Pulte could be responsible for expenses, but not assessments. And until it's sold to a third party, then no one's responsible for assessments, except then the third party is responsible for assessments after it's sold.
Again, that's Pulte's position. I think our position is a little different. We don't agree with that completely. I think largely because the association's position is that the common expenses are at least presumptively equivalent to the assessments. The association, by its own terms, cannot just make up an assessment number. It has to base the assessments on the total common expenses. So, at least at a prima facie level, the association would submit that the assessment in this case is equal to the consequences. That may not always be true. Again, there may be communities that have different declarations to calculate their assessments differently, to go back to Judge Kerberly's question. In this particular case, the association would say that yes, the common expenses and the assessments are equal in value. But again, there was a lot of confusion on this point, and again, that's part of the reason we opposed summary judgment.
So the last question before we hear opposing counsel. When Pulte was still in charge of the HOA, where did the HOA's assets come from?
I believe that Pulte, I don't know if that's in the record, but I believe typically what would happen is the developer would set up a bank account for the association and it would put a certain amount of capital in there. It would attempt to calculate what the future association's expenses would be. It would include something according to what is in the record actually is Todd Leavitt's deposition testimony. He was the 3B6 representative of Pulte Homes, and he indicated that normally they would pay for all these expenses or subsidize the association somehow so that Pulte was paying its own load. He noted in particular that the expense for lighting, he wasn't sure if that had actually happened or not, but he said it did, and absolutely that was wrong. Pulte would make the association whole or something to that effect. I think that's on, or is it 399 of the record, is the excerpt of his deposition testimony.
So do I understand correctly then that while Pulte was in charge of the HOA, they essentially did a significant amount of funding of the HOA and then would use HOA assets to pay for some of these common aspects?
Yes, well, I think I may have misspoken a little bit or left out part of that. Initially, Pulte would set up the association, and I think under standard corporate law, they have a duty to capitalize it to some level. After that, as they start selling units, homeowner funds would take over. And I want to emphasize that because that's really the issue here is that for an extended period, Pulte's employees and later homeowner elected members were using association funds that they collected from the homeowners to pay maintenance on this other property.
Is that part of the record?
Yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, Chris Dawes, attorney registration 33818. I want to touch on a few of the issues that came up during opposing counsel's argument. One of the questions you asked Judge Carparelli had to do with the damage model that was presented by the association below. And I think we need to be very clear on what was asked for and how the claim was developed. Because what the association did is they treated these assessments as HOA dues. So they treated each and every assessment to Pulte. And again, we should be clear, there are only actually two invoices that went to Pulte in December 2010. But they treated Pulte just as they treated each and every other homeowner, which means necessarily they didn't specifically identify expenses that tie to anything different. So when we talk about 307, we necessarily have to go back and we have to look at what has been annexed into the community. And in here, some of the questions you had just for us touched on this. These units were not part of the community. They never were until they were deeded by Pulte.
Okay, the section on annexation talks about annexing additional property. And so use of the term additional implies that there's some property that's within the community before it's annexed.
Well, I think that's true.
Well, how can it be within the community if annexation is what brings it into the community?
I think what we start as we look at what's been described as being subject or potentially subject to governance by the CCNRs, by the covenants that we have here.
Is that the plat?
And so, no, I think we actually look at the CCNRs themselves. When we look at, I believe it's Exhibit D. Exhibit D lays out and says, these are all lots that may be subject to the CCNRs. And then we look at the annexation provisions that we see. And the annexation provisions are very clear. There's two methodologies by which these units can come in.
Well, it says additional property, so I'm still not clear on how initial property comes into the community.
Well, there is no property within the community until there's an annexation agreement that's recorded that brings it in. That's the second method. Or until Pulte deeds that property to a third party.
Okay.
So that would be the additional property coming into the community.
But what's the initial property?
There is no property to begin with. When you look at Exhibit D, it's very clear that there's nothing that starts within the community. You have a regime, and then lots are added within it.
Seems very strange to me that they would say annex additional property if there is no property to begin with.
Well, again, what I would say is you've got lots, and you've got property which can be subject to the declaration, and which, again, through the annexation process, in fact, does become subject to it. And
okay.
Again, I think the additional I understand your question, but that suggests there was something within the community to begin with. I don't think that there is. The way Exhibit A is laid out, it's very clear.
Well, if the plat brings it within the community, then there would be property that could be later added to, additional by annexation. There's no definition of annexation, right?
There's not. I believe there's a title to that section talks about annexation, and then there's certainly a definition within that article.
Well, it talks about how you can bring in additional property, but that doesn't necessarily mean annex as to initial property brought into the community. I mean, annex could be the identification of the 186 lots and recorded on the plat, and then there's other ways to bring in additional property. It's not the meets. Maybe there's, if you have the meets and bounds that are first identified by the declaration and there's divided into 186 plats, we know that 186 is the maximum. But let's say that there's some other property that's not divided yet. Okay, so then, let's say that in the process of developing, you want to, Pulte wants to jiggle around the property lines, which apparently can, it can do if it's subject to developer rights. Okay, and so, it's, what is property that's subject to developer rights if there's no property in the community and the, it doesn't come into the community until it's sold?
Well, you have a good example that would be common elements. If you have common elements here, that in fact did exist and were in fact, conveyed from Pulte to the association. I think that was sometime in 2004. So that for example, theoretically, while Pulte was a title holder to those common elements, theoretically the association could have expenses that they might try to assess subject to 307. That's not our record here. That's not what happened here. There are no common element expenses that are ever broken out or assessed to Pulte.
Okay, so you're saying common elements are within the community, but they haven't been deeded to a third party.
I believe the record reflects the conveyance to the association.
And so that's when they become within the community? The common elements are not within the community until they're deeded to the association?
I think that's true.
Well, can they just be listed, annexed by listing them on Exhibit D without actually deeding them?
You could, I think you would either deed them or alternatively, there's a second methodology which talks about an annexation agreement.
Yeah.
And then we see there are five specific criteria as to how an annexation agreement operates. There's words affecting annexation, there's an effective date of the annexation, and there's a few other elements, none of which are present here.
Okay, well, let's look at 307. What would be real estate within the common interest community subject to development rights? Because if it's deeded to a third party, how can it be subject to development rights?
Well, I think by the, when it is deeded to that third party, I would agree. I don't think it's subject, barring a separate agreement, and there certainly could be a separate agreement. I don't think it's necessarily subject to development rights at that point.
And so 307, basically that language has no meaning in our situation. Because there is no real estate subject to development rights because it won't be in the community until it's sold.
Or that it's otherwise subject to an annexation agreement. And again, this is why I go back and I look at the damage model that was presented by the association here. And again, what they did is they did assessments community-wide and they issued invoices to their homeowners and said, these are your HOA dues. Then they went back 7 years after the fact and they tried to make those identical HOA dues assessments payable by Pulte. And the record is not developed to suggest there's anything particular to Pulte, that there's anything that would constitute an expense in connection with real estate within the common interest community subject to development rights. There's no breakout, there's no analysis, there's nothing like that.
And that's a whole different issue. We have to get past this threshold issue of what the declaration means in terms of what's within the community, what it means in the statute to be within the community. We have to get past all that first before we can look at anything relating to allocation. I want to go back to this 307-2. It sounds like your position is that a declarant like Pulte, if it holds property merely subject to development rights, that's not within the common interest community. But if that's the case, then 307-2 makes no sense at all. But that's, it sounds like, isn't that what you're saying? Pulte holds property, it hasn't sold it, they're subject to development rights. But your position is that's not part of the common interest community. Because it hasn't been sold.
Well, I think it's not necessarily subject to the common interest community, but I think there can be liability for expense incurred in those items if the association were to take that on and to specifically assess Pulte in this instance for those expenditures.
All right.
Theoretically, you could have a claim, but again, that's not a record.
That's, you're conflating liability with damages. Okay, it seems like to me you've just conceded potential liability if you're climbing under 307-2. Liability, you're just contesting how much it is. I mean, you're just saying because they didn't parse it out properly, we can't be liable for it. But you're not contesting that 307-2 applies to the land that's subject to development rights, are you?
I think 307-2 plainly speaks to land subject to development rights. What I would say here is, there is no liability, there's no damages, because there's never been the association never identified any particular expenses that would fall within this category. They never assessed for them. They never invoiced for them. And this is not an undeveloped record. This is the case that was pending for over a year and for which summary judgment entered just weeks before a trial. We had expert reports. We had all sorts of things. And again, there isn't that kind of breakout or analysis. There's not a single expenditure identified otherwise.
But it seems like what you're saying is there are no, like you say, no expenses that have been specifically identified pursuant to this statute. Therefore, we can't be liable for the expenses. Okay, that's a damages question. I mean, it doesn't seem like you're contesting that. Yeah, theoretically, if they were to come to us with a bill and say, here are the expenses we spent on the property subject to development rights, the Pulte would be liable for that.
But theoretically, I suppose that's possible. However, we didn't have that. Again, when we look at this record, the common elements were deeded from Pulte to the association in 2004.
But we don't have a summary judgment here based upon insufficient evidence of specific damages. That's not what we've got. We've got a summary judgment here based upon a finding of no breach of contract, no liability. Seems to me you're conceding there's a potential liability. They just haven't given you the information to determine the correct amount.
Well, I would contest that and suggest that I don't think there's anything in this record established that there is liability, let alone damages on top of it. Again, the case was never developed or framed as a 307 type claim. There's nothing in the record, period, on that. And so I don't think there is any liability because the case wasn't framed as such. Well, it wasn't developed as such.
Let me get back to the language of the statute. Are you contesting, or are you saying that even though Pulte had owned property subject to development rights, that property was not within the common interest community within the meaning of 307? If so, why?
Well, Pulte did own property at one time which was subject to development rights. And that would have been sometime before 2004, before it deeded that. So pre-2004, again, while Pulte would have been subsidizing the association for whatever expenses it had, yes, I think there could have been assessments to that effect.
All right. Now we're touching on something else. So are you saying that these other lots, the 186 lots, that it was selling at one at a time, that those are not properties subject to development rights? Or are they?
Well, certainly after they're deeded,
before they're deeded.
I think those could be subject to development rights.
And therefore, they'd be within 307.
Well, I don't think they're within 307. Again, I go back here and I look at trying to identify the expenses for which there could be some liability attaching to Pulte. In this case, I don't see anything in this record that suggests that was ever the case. Again, the assessments that were made were community-wide, and they were specific to those folks that Pulte had deeded the property to for units which were actually annexed into the community.
You're just saying they didn't prove the damage. I mean,
well, I don't think they proved the liability either because it was never presented that way. It was never pled that way. And again, when you go back and look at the record, there's nothing to support that claim that was before the trial court at the time of the summary judgment. If I could turn briefly to the unjust enrichment argument, and you look at unjust enrichment.
Mr. Dawes, I'll be extending your time as well.
Okay, thank you. When you look at the unjust enrichment argument, again, there's reference by the association to certain of the restatement provisions. I don't think you ever get there because you do have the covenants that are in place, and those covenants speak to these issues. So we're not trying to make a quasi-contractual substitute here. We're looking at specific agreements in provisions that govern these issues. So I don't think we ever get to the issue of unjust enrichment.
So your position on that is, so long as there is an agreement that covers the subject matter, there cannot be a claim for unjust enrichment. even if that contract, under that contract, it means there's no liability for your farm.
I think that's right. If the general topic is dealt with within the document, if there's a gaping hole in the document as to how expenses or maintenance issues are going to be dealt with, that's not the case here. But if that were, then theoretically, you could look outside the covenant. But again, we don't have that here. Again, I look at on the fiduciary duty issue, it's a somewhat similar concept when you look at what Kiowa is, and we have a claim for breach of fiduciary duty that's been asserted against Pulte. And as a declarant, there is no provision for a fiduciary duty to exist from declarant to an association. So it's effectively been preempted by Kiowa. And when we look at the Belvedere case out of Ohio, we look at the district court decision, which of course is not binding on this court, but the analysis makes sense, and that is you've got a particular statutory regime that's in place that governs this issue, and there is no provision for a declarant to have any direct fiduciary duties to an association. So it's similar to that unjust enrichment concept in the sense that in this case we have the CCNRs that governs the issues of maintenance and expenses. That doesn't permit the association to look outside the agreement to find provisions that it prefers.
But you will concede that the I'll just call them directors because I'm not remembering the correct term, but those whom Pulte appointed to serve on the board, they have fiduciary obligations.
I would agree.
Okay. So on what legal authority do you base your apparent position that Pulte can't be liable for the actions of its employees in that capacity?
Well, because again, I think I would look to the actual statute. I would look to what Kiowa provides in terms of who may be liable and who owes those fiduciary duties. And 303-2A is very clear as to who owes those fiduciary duties. And who is not included is the declarant in this case. There is a provision that specifically deals with the issue, and it does not include the declarant.
But you take that a step farther and say, in effect, that means that the doctrine of respondeat superior has been done away with in this context.
Well, and what I would say is when you look at the Belvedere decision and you look at the Vigil or Vigil decision that's cited in the Okamichi decision, yes, I think the legislature decided who could have that fiduciary obligation and spoke to that. The legislature did not include a declarant as somebody who owes a fiduciary duty. Instead, they were quite specific as to who did. So I would submit that, in a sense, that issue has been preempted by Kyle. Had the legislature wanted to make the declarant liable, be it through respondeat superior or otherwise, they could have.
Wouldn't that put the employees in a potential conflict of interest to have a fiduciary duty to the homeowners association and at the same time to have obligations to their employer? How can they act independently?
I think they can act independently in the sense that they do owe specific fiduciary duties to the association. I don't think there's any doubt of that. I think if there were a time a director believed that there was something they were being asked to do that didn't comport with that, I think there's ways to deal with that. But I don't think that presented in this case. But again, I think that there's clearly an indisputable fiduciary duty owed by a declarant appointed director to the association.
But the declarant appoints its own employees because it expects those employees to do what the declarant wants, and that's just common sense.
Well, I mean, one may have that view, but I think also the declarant appoints those directors knowing that those directors do, in fact, have fiduciary duties owed to the association.
So you're saying it's realistic that Pulte could give the directors an instruction, we want you to do this, and the directors would just say, no, that's contrary to our fiduciary duties, in which case, of course, Pulte would fire them and replace them with somebody else.
Anything is possible. That has not been my experience, and I would submit that It's not uncommon that there may be indemnity provisions. And so I think that the Pulte, at the end of the day, or a builder generally, isn't going to put its employees in harm's way by causing them to breach fiduciary duties, for which there may be, in fact, a liability for those directors that can, in fact, come back to roost one way or another with the builder, be it for an employment-based claim or otherwise. But I don't think that's a free pass for the builder to have its employees appointed as directors without any consequence. I think there may be consequence. I just don't think it's under common law, and I don't think it's as it was pleaded by the association in this case. On the issue of attorney's fees.
Maybe before you go there, I want to go back to 307.2. Right at the beginning, it says, in addition to liability that a declarant as a unit owner has under this article, the declarant alone is liable for all expenses in connection with the real estate within common interest, within the common interest community, subject to development rights. Now, I know we've talked about whether the property is inside the community or not within the community. My question is, what's an example of a liability for an expense that to which this would pertain? And I'm talking about an expense other than a unit owner liability.
Okay. Let's say that there may be Pulte Nate on a unit which hasn't yet been annexed. And let's say that there was a fire on one of its lots, and the association took it upon itself to pay somebody to put the fire out. Theoretically, I think something like that could fall within the ambit of this provision.
Okay. Thank you. So Pulte would have the liability, and the homeowners association, if they took the initiative, they could recoup that expense from Pulte.
I think that's right. If it were properly, if it in fact were something specific to that Pulte-owned property and was presented as such, yes, I think 307 would allow for that.
Thank you. Go ahead. About attorney's fees.
On the issue of attorney's fees, the trial court did not hold a hearing on that. I would submit, we're certainly familiar with the Roberts v. Adams decision. There does seem to be not an entire consistency between Rule 121, which talks about when a trial court may use its discretion to hold a hearing under, I think, Section 1-22. And some of the case law has taught that the court should, in fact, or is obligated to, in fact, hold a hearing. When you look at the Roberts v. Adams case, that does seem to suggest that as a condition proceeding, the party opposing the reasonableness of those fees needs to submit an affidavit for that non-discretionary hearing requirement to kick in. And that was not the case here. There was no affidavit which was submitted in opposition to Pulte's fees. In fact, most all of the argument went to legal entitlement, not as to reasonableness of fees. Are there any other issues I can address for the panel?
Apparently not. Thank you, Mr. Doss.
Thank you.
Bailiff, would you give Mr. Witt 4 minutes?
Thank you. And my registration number is 33241, which I forgot to say before. I'd like to respond initially to the kind of the tail end there of the argument concerning, you know, attorney fees. The Roberts case, as I recall, there wasn't actually a request for a hearing in that case. We've addressed those in the brief, however, and I think it's pretty clear that there's not a conflict that if a party requests a hearing, they're entitled to have one, and we believe that was there.
Mr. Wood, I want to focus on something Mr. Dawes said about 3072 and the expenses that are recoverable there under, it does appear to say that, the expenses, whatever those happen to be, we've already talked about that, but whatever they happen to be, have to be attributable to the specific property of the declarant that is subject to developer rights. But here, it looks like what the association did is it took all the expenses it's ever had and just prorated throughout the whole community, and just prorated, assessed it to everyone, including Pulte. Is that accurate?
Not exactly. What the association did, and there's a spreadsheet that's in the record,
right,
that defines this, it looked at the dates that the units were completed. It didn't try to charge Pulte everything. It only charged them for the time that the units were completed and constructed. And I guess maybe getting back to Judge Worst's question, I think that was maybe the real date that these properties came into the community, is when the construction was finished.
But there's, is there any evidence in the records of any particular expenses that are applicable to those properties that were subject to development rights? And if not, how does your claim survive?
Well,
at least under 307.
I think there is some evidence, particularly the affidavit of Lisa Klin, what was it, page 257, 258 of the record. She notes that she didn't put a dollar value on it, but she does note that there were specific expenses, that a portion of the HOA's expenses were spent on Pulte plots. And as I noted earlier, I think it's reasonable to assume that the pro-rata cost of painting three-fourths of a building was roughly three-fourths of that building, or three-fourths of the assessments allocated to that building. That is an approximation, and I think it's one that could have been explored further, but wasn't. She also notes in her affidavit that there was an expense for added lighting that was totally separate, that should have been 100% Pulte, not even a common expense. That was a transaction that was expressly prohibited in the declaration, and they absolutely had to pay that back, even their own witness.
But if you were to go to trial with your spreadsheet, why wouldn't the court just say, you haven't proved any expense specific to these properties subject to development rights? Therefore, case dismissed.
I don't know if the court would do that. I think the court would say that it's a question for the jury to decide, well, was this reasonable? Was this an approximation? Certainly, at trial, the association would have presented more evidence than the six paragraphs in Ms. Quinn's affidavit. We would have called her. She would have walked the jury through all those expenses, explained what they were. She would have been subject to cross-examination.
I have a quick question. Are you using unit and lot interchangeably?
I am. And
because, I mean, the declaration says each owner is a person who owns a lot, and that's a little different from when a unit is constructed, et cetera, et cetera.
And I apologize. I am. Kiowa refers to unit. I think that's a more common term, but I may sometimes use those interchangeably without thinking about it. In this particular case, lot was a term that was used. If you actually look at the definition of Kiowa, the definitions in Kiowa, I think we cited this in footnotes somewhere, you don't have to use the word unit. So I would say in this case, lot and unit are interchangeable.
So let me ask about the lighting issue, for example. So was the lighting issue a common area lighting, or was it specific to any lot?
I believe that was common area lighting.
And was that expense incurred while Pulte had control of the HOA, or after Pulte ceded control to the owners?
According to paragraph 5 of Ms. Quinn's affidavit, she says that Pulte employees used the monies to make at least one capital improvement in the form of added lighting. So that would indicate that it was during the time of declarant control. Okay. And again, that was almost an undisputed issue. And I think it's particularly instructive here at a summary judgment proceeding, because I, at a minimum, even if the court had thrown out some of the other case, that was essentially conceded by Pulte's witness that they were liable for that, and summary judgment can't stand it.
Why are they liable for that? I mean, it's a common element thing. The common elements were conveyed to the association in 2004, so it's not Pulte's property anymore, it's association property. So why is Pulte liable for that?
Because there's a specific provision in the declaration that says the declarant has to pay for all capital improvements like that.
All right, so it's a cap.
Yeah, and it's, it distinguishes it. That is one thing. One of the improvements, you know, adding something new, there's a special provision in the declaration that deals with that. And again, Mr. Lita, Pulte's witness, acknowledged that they were liable for that. And the reason is that it was done when they were still selling units. It's, I think, the declaration, and I believe there's a similar provision in Kiowa that treats that as basically almost a marketing type thing. It's that improves the community so they can sell more units, they have to pay for that. And that was undisputed. And the minimum judgment should not have entered on that claim.
Mr. Witt, if you'll wrap up, I can't guarantee there won't be any more questions, but
we'll try very quickly. I appreciate the additional time. Just on the NJEP enrichment issue, I heard Mr. Dawes say that as long as something's addressed in a general topic in the declaration, that's sufficient. Well, that's not what the case law says. The Supreme Court and addition to this court have recognized that if something goes outside the scope of a contract, the court needs to, you know, there is a potential unjust enrichment claim there, and the court needs to make specific findings on it. It's error to simply say that the declaration talks about maintaining some property, so all maintenance costs forever can never be the subject of an unjust enrichment claim. Again, it can't really have it both ways. This property was either in the community and subject to 307, or it was outside the community and outside the declaration. With regard to the responding superior argument, there's nothing in Kiowa that suggests the legislature intended to overrule that longstanding doctrine. There would need to be something specific as a matter of statutory interpretation, there would need to be something specific in statute stating that, you know, we disagree with this court's decision and need to overrule responding superior. We don't want responding superior to apply. All the conflict of interest issues that the report raised, I think, are very legitimate, particularly the situation that Judge Jones mentioned, that, you know, what would happen if an employee was caught between his employer's directive and the risk of being fired and replaced with somebody who would take a company line. Nothing in Kiowa suggests that there's not a fiduciary duty claim against the declarant in that situation. Kiowa, what it does say, is it's to be construed broadly. And in that instance, I think the fiduciary duty is important, and Kiowa would allow that claim to go forward. As we noted in the footnotes, it's maybe an interesting academic question of what happens if Fulty appoints someone who's not an employee to the board. Is there still a duty? Maybe, maybe not. But that's not the case that's before us, because the employees the individuals were employees, and, you know, as Ms. Klinge again testified, they, as far as she could tell, were acting within the scope of their employment, wearing Fulty shirts and indicating that their primary focus was to benefit Pulte. And then finally, I think the court stated a little more clearly that the issue I was fumbling with a little bit, which is that the argument really is that there was never a motion for summary judgment on damages. And I believe Pulte really is conflating the concepts of liability and damages. In the trial court, they talked a little bit about the damages. They conceded that there was, as they did today, that Section 307 would allow the association to recoup expenses. Now, they mentioned that they don't think the damages were established, but that was never the issue that was brought on summary judgment. I think that they certainly could have debated that issue. They could have filed a motion for summary judgment on damages. If the matter is remanded for trial, I think that's a legitimate argument for them to make, that we think this number is too high, it should be a smaller number. But they conceded that there's liability, which is the whole issue that was raised on summary judgment. The example of fire that Mr. Dawes gave, I would ask, how is putting out a fire fundamentally different from painting a unit to prevent rain damage, or putting out fire blocking, or any of the other maintenance tasks that the association had to do? And Fulty concedes that it's liable for those tasks to protect its units, Fulty's property. It necessarily follows that the association had a claim here and established liability under Section 307, notwithstanding any dispute at trial as to the actual dollar amount.
Thank you, Mr. Witt.
Thank you.
Counsel, thank you very much. You were thorough and articulate, and we really appreciate when someone comes in and has their facts and their details together. Appreciate it. We will be in recess. We'll shoot 7 minutes.